I love it. I love our new song so much. I'm going to keep talking about it because I love it. Hi, Steph. What's up?
I'm great. I'm excited that it's already our third episode of The Game Diaries.
I can't believe it. We've made it. We've made three in.
Three in. Well, almost three in. I must say it's, I feel that we're, you know, we're riding a bicycle and we're gaining momentum, you know?
Yeah.
You know, when you get on it, it's like, can get pretty hard, especially if you're downhill, but then like, you know.
Yeah, we got it.
We're getting in the
We even we actually just recorded our first minisode as well.
Yes.
And that's gonna come out, we think, on Fridays.
On Fridays. Like if we have one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let us know if you prefer on the weekends, but on Fridays. But we're aiming for Fridays for the minisodes.
We got a follow up with Rebecca Berger Becky Heinemann from our first entry, and she is delightful. I love her. I can't wait for everybody to hear it. So that'll come. That's coming at you guys soon. What you been playing, Steph?
Okay, so I've been playing a couple of cool things. So I've been playing. You know what? I'm trying to do more videos in French for my YouTube. Like, it's a very small channel, and I'm trying to play all these indie games, and I played Planet Zoo for the first time. You probably heard about it, right?
I don't know Planet Zoo.
Oh, so it's like a roller coaster tycoon.
Okay,
kind of type, but for zoos, and you have like your animals, and you take care of them and whatnot. And it's been really relaxing. I've been enjoying it. It's kind of fun.
A zoo sim,
but it has a lot more depth than I thought it would.
Interesting.
Like, you have to like buy the right food. You can put it wherever you want. You know, like, they have to be happy animals. They can't just be like there, right? So you have to take care of the park and make money and whatnot. But you also have to take care of the animals and make sure that your staff is like taking care of them. So it's kind of fun. I like it. Is this on mobile? Really close. No, it's on the PC. Yeah.
Okay.
And you can zoom in pretty close to see like good quality animals, like that lion when it just yawns with like all of his fur. Aww. It's like, oh, I want to pet him so bad.
that's like the closest you're gonna get to having a cat, apparently.
Yeah, I'm not getting
from
a
what
cat
I hear
anytime soon. I already have a fox, though, a little fox.
You do.
She's Loki. She's upset. Yeah, she's upset right now. I don't know what's going on.
She wants attention.
Yeah, she usually around dinner time, she's like, okay, you guys should be done with work right now. Let's have fun. but not tonight. It's a long day for me tonight.
I guess so. It's right. You're 3 hours ahead of me.
Yeah, it's
so
5 p.m. Yeah.
I'm like, wow, dinner. It's like not even 2 yet here.
Sunny. You know, the sun is gone here. It's dark. It's nighttime here.
What time is it dark for you? Because for us, it's like 4:30, 5,
yeah, about 4:30. Yeah.
Okay.
So but you guys in the summer last longer. Like, our summer sun is like 8:30-ish, but I feel that in LA it's like 9:30, sometimes 10.
I could super get rid of daylight savings. Like, this whole, I don't need it. Like, I don't like when it gets darker earlier. Like, maybe I could be a better morning person and like wake up at 6 a.m. and not stay up till, you know, like, maybe I could be a better morning person so that I can actually like enjoy, you know, my morning and the daytime, but I like when it stays a little darker. I don't know why we need it. I mean, I get like some people go to work really early, so they want it to be lighter, I guess.
But it's, you know, here it's still dark in the morning. So it's like, it doesn't really change anything. Like, we live in the north, Michelle. It's like frozen and you're waking up and you're just like,
yeah.
That winter is pretty rough. Like what you see in the Viking stuff, like, is exactly what it is.
I've been to Toronto one time in the winter, and it was cold, and it was cold, like the wind was cold, and it was dark. But that was a fun town, though. I had a lot of fun in that town, like walking.
Yeah,
around
we have to have fun because everything else is so depressing. I always say, I feel that's why we're good at video games and making video games, and then just in general at like. Like, our bars and nightlives are fun because nothing else is fun in the winter
here. It's like
here,
a really
right?
cool, like, walking around to like different music venues ish kind of scene. It was really cool. Like, a lot more relaxed than here, in America, in like Los Angeles. You can't really walk around to a lot of bars. Like they're not really next to each other, you know?
Yeah. Oh, wow. Okay. No, it's quite frequent here in Montreal and even in Quebec. You kind of bar up all night. Hey, do you want to switch? You want to go here or across the street? Or yeah, it's all the
time. You can kind of do that on like the Sunset Strip, but that's a completely different kind of experience, you know? Like that's more like you need to be dressed good and like maybe someone will let you in because they're being like door person.
I've never thought about that before. You're right. I don't think I've ever been like in a place in especially in LA where you just bar up or you just, let's go meet our friends across the street. They're there right now. Like that doesn't really happen. No.
I mean, the beach, I guess, has a little bit more of that. But even then, so many people want to get into those places. Like because they're on the ocean or like in that area. Like I think it's Long Beach, maybe one of the Newport Beach has got like a really cool walk around bar scene, but like it's still pretty busy. It's still, they're still not easy to just like go walk into. You're like, I just miss going out and going to bars and like seeing friends.
Yeah, that's not happening anytime soon. I know I told you already, but we're in complete lockdown here and it was extended for another month. So we're not seeing anyone anytime soon.
No, I mean, there's so many people out in America, I don't even know what to do.
Yeah, like, you guys is the opposite.
Never leaving my house. Like, it's never happening. This has been such a crazy week, too. I just have to say, like, you know,
you barely sleep, right?
I didn't sleep last night. Yeah. I was up all night playing the game of
life. Playing the game of life?
Playing the actual game
of
life.
Where are you watching the elections? Like, are you watching on TV or are you like Twitter?
I was like reading the news. Yeah. Like just literally horrible, junky, doom scrolling. Like, you know, because I just want it. I know everybody needs to take their time and I'm glad everyone is being like careful and counting every vote. But it's nerve wracking. I just want it. It's like I can taste like the victory. And somebody on Twitter said it best. They were like, it's kind of like, it's New Year's Eve and you're ready to celebrate New Year's, but you don't know when midnight is. This weird, good like, one. But I gotta say, I think my favorite part of this week has been the memes. There's been some really great memes this week.
Know.
Like all my friends stopped talking in like actual words and we're just sending each other memes to get through it.
Max was doing that too. He was saying like, did you see that one? Did you see that one? And actually I've been trying to stay away. The first night I was really intense too. I didn't sleep at all. But I figured when I woke up and nothing had changed from the night when I went to bed, I figured I'd better off like kind of doing my own things or else I was just going to be like you, like I'll pause.
Oh yeah. It'd be crazy.
The whole week.
Absolutely insane. Yeah. I did though download, Team Fight Tactics on Granny Island.
Yes.
I did. Yes.
I love
she
that
leveled
game.
Up. It's fun, but you know what? I have got to learn. I completely forgot about like all of the gear stuff in League of Legends and then realized, oh, like I need to learn the gear on how to upgrade each item because
wait,
I'm
so
just
you
like
play
playing
on the iPad. Okay. Okay. So I was thinking, cause on the PC, I play with add-ons that tell me which items to buy for which character.
Add-ons. Mm-hmm.
You
That's
play WoW, so you
it.
Know.
That's how you're doing it. Yeah, I'm just playing on the. I don't think it has anything like that. Maybe I'm gonna have
think
to play
on
it
on the iPad. But you should try. Like I learn the most when I play with these add-ons. Like they tell me, okay, you could play this comp, or you should switch, or the chances of winning with this comp is really low.
Oh,
in this,
okay.
So please,
because
swap,
I was thinking you know? Like the choosing time is actually pretty low and I'm like trying to look into each one and look at the chart of like what thing is going to create whatever and it doesn't give me any time and I'm constantly feeling like I'm stupid because I'm like can I just not read fast enough, but I think I'm pretty quick. It's just people are using add-ons to like make those decisions. I need to do
you can also like research a build, get into a game and just try to execute that build. So sell everything just until you get that build and then you just try to go as far as you can with it, and that's how you can learn how to like play some build, and then one day you'll just see that you'll be like, oh, I'll just do that build, I know it, and then you just do it, you know,
because Granny iPad, she can't do all of them. She can't do all the add-ons.
I'm excited though that you're getting into TFT. I love the game. It's really cool.
Yeah, it's fun. I think it like just varied up my week a little bit. Like, just gave me something else. I'm like, I was like, I really have no idea what I'm doing at this point. But, and then like when they're all standing in the circle in the middle and you have to, like, to pick one of those on an iPad is like, they that's just the run challenge. Toward, oh my God.
That's a challenge.
I'm like, that's not that guy. And then I've got a guy and like, it's the whole thing. And then I'm like, I don't know why I'm playing this. I feel my phone
sometimes and that's also very challenging. So,
you have to know all of the.
Yeah.
I'll memorize. I'll get to that point. We'll see in my evolution. You know what else I really liked about last week was your entry on DJ Wheat. Like, I ended learning so much more about him too, and like reading that article on his website. And I really some great. He's got just such a fantastic, fascinating career, and he sent us cat pictures.
I actually. I'm very impressed. So far, we've had Becky and DJ Wheat Marcus, and they both reacted so positively to the episodes, and they tweeted about them, and, you know, Becky came on the show, and Scoop, Marcus said he would be down to also get interviewed. So far, you know, it's quite surreal.
Keeping
the whole
busy.
Process has been surreal, Michelle. I'm glad
it's keeping us busy.
We're doing this, and you know, producer Danny behind the scene, and then the other people supporting us. And I think that one thing we're gonna try to work on in the next episodes, I have to kind of mention it, is that we do a lot of research behind the scene, and we do utilize a lot of the content that's already out there, like from articles to interviews and whatnot. And the DJ one, we got pretty lucky because he actually had a writer write a book on him for his website, and I just want to make sure that we mention how beautiful that research was, because like
really
I said
fantastic.
we were pretty lucky. His name is Jeff Kim, and if you go to jeff.kim/Marcus-Graham, you're gonna see everything that he did on Marcus, and also is Twitter is at jeff.kim. So we'll put that, you know, we'll create some kind of a probably like a mini website where we'll put all the links.
So you guys can go dive deeper, you know, if you want on some of these subjects, you know, because like so much about we're like, you know, really only telling like snapshots too. Like you were saying with DJ Wheat, he's got the entire like what has happened since with Twitch that is covered in that piece. So yeah, there's a lot of information out there.
You know what I did too, Michelle? So this is the first time I actually sit down and listen to an episode of My Favorite Murder since COVID.
Oh yeah?
Cause usually I travel a lot by car across the country. I'm sorry if you can hear the little baby girl in behind the scene, but so so I travel a lot, and I drive Quebec, Montreal, which is about a 2.5-3 hour drive almost every week. And so that's how I caught up on my podcast, but I haven't been doing that and I haven't found the time. But to wake myself up yesterday, I sat and I was like, why don't I listen to another My Favorite Murder, which was an inspiration for this podcast. And I actually realized they do a lot of small talk at the beginning.
They do.
They're
like for like 40 minutes.
Yeah. They do a lot of small talk before they get to the episode.
They're really funny.
They are so good. They're super
funny.
Awesome.
Yeah, I'm into it. I like their I'm glad you introduced me to it because I wasn't really familiar with the podcast prior, and now I love it. Like it's and I never really considered myself like a big like true crime person, but I don't know. I love the way it's presented. It's fun.
It is really fun. And they're their stories that they read also is really fun. So, guys, if you have any stories, send us your gaming stories because we want to read them on our show. I think those could be potentially some of our bigger stories. And even like nicest moment on the show was to read what you guys are going through. And, I'm excited to read more. Also, I started a new series on Netflix. It's called Barbarians.
Barbarians?
Yes.
I don't know it.
It's like a 6-episode for season 1. And I thought, oh, no, not another like Game of Thrones Viking kind of thing. But Max convinced me, so we sat down and we watched it. And so far, I really like it. It feels, first of all, it's all in Latin and in Germanic. So it's not in English. It's subtitles. So it's like the actual languages of what the Vikings and the Romans from Julius Caesars would speak. So that, first of all, is already really interesting.
Yeah.
It's like so authentic. And I wonder how they did it. I wonder how if the characters had to learn the language.
Constructed the language, yeah.
Can you imagine being an actress and speaking just random things? Like she has to think, for example, let's say there's a character and someone dies and she has to think, say no in a random language. And she has to feel it and mean it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, to be honest, like sometimes that the language can really help to an actor because it's all about like tone, like how you say something. So they don't even necessarily need to know the word or the language. I mean, it's better obviously, but like if you know that, like what your subtext is, it kind of makes it, I mean, it really brings it to life. Mm-hmm. I actually don't mind subtitles at all. In fact, truth be told, on Game of Thrones, I always put the subtitles on because there were so many like son of and, you know, and they would all have the same names. And I was really trying. I've not read the book. So I was really trying to like keep it all straight. And I've got that kind of personality where I've got to like really understand it, you know, when it keeps like piling on. So I have to understand the base of it. So I'll throw those on. And it's fine. Like, I don't know. It never stops me. You know,
I always have it on.
Good,
I don't understand half of the words they're saying, and I have to like rewind. But then I read. So I feel you. It's always on for me too.
Well, that's cool. Maybe I'll check it out. It's on Netflix.
And it's just 6 episodes, right? So it goes by pretty fast. We're at episode 4, and you know, they don't really beat around the bush. I like these kind of series. I don't know if you watched The Witcher.
Oh, yeah, I did.
Okay,
I
love The Witcher. Oh, my God, it was so good. And, you know, they don't beat around the bush. They're like, you know what, let's get the story rolling. You know, it's episode 3. We need to be like, let's go.
Yeah, I could have done with The Witcher. I'm excited for more fantasy shows. Like, I like that genre quite a bit. And it doesn't get done well all the time, especially when, like, magic is involved. But The Witcher, I could have done with a little bit more backstory about who a Witcher is, what a Witcher is, and what they do, and like give a little bit more understanding to the listener or to the viewer about what that is. Cause a lot of people who didn't play the game franchise don't know at all, don't understand it. So that that's the only part, but otherwise, like, it was really fun. I liked it.
Loved The Witcher, and it's my favorite game, and it's from my favorite universe. So pretty excited. Yeah, I couldn't believe when they announced it. And when we watched, I was crying every episode. And obviously the song amazing. And we listened to it for weeks. And I have tears in my eyes just thinking about it.
Was it the coin to the Witcher?
Toss a coin to your Witcher, oh Valley of Plenty.
I sing that to my cats sometimes with like, you know, something in, like they just stare at me and my husband's like, you're literally losing your mind. I'm like, I know. I've been inside for a really long time.
But you went
often like I'll throw like words like that have to do with their food or their name. I mean, come on, we all know we do it. We like sing our animal songs.
I was thinking about it this morning. I talk to my dog like she's a human, right? Do you like? Is it weird or
sometimes
do we all do?
It's like half the time where I'll like ask them a question or you know. Like,
and I talked to her really seriously, like, why are you doing that? You know, I don't like it. Like, you know, like I'm in a conversation with her or I'm like, lucky today, I don't feel good. I'd love for you to hug me a little bit more. You know, like, I'm just like, she's my therapist.
Teaching her empathy.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, you're supposed to do this. This is your job. Yeah, exactly.
I forgot today's topic, and I'm so happy because usually like we don't tell each other stories, but we kind of just make sure that we don't pick the same story,
right? Or like,
and I completely forgot who you're doing today, so I'm pretty excited.
Oh, really? Oh, good. Yeah, because I wasn't sure if like you wanted to cover him. So I asked you about it because that's the other thing too. I'm like, I don't want to take one away from you if you like, really, really want to cover it. But yeah, so I, you know, I've been this, one of the reasons I picked this person was because like, I've been thinking a lot about like the state of the world and like, you know, the actions of society and humanity and like, what if this is actually just a giant simulation and a bunch of aliens are just like controlling us? And like, that's just because the world is so crazy right now. It just feels so upset. Like, so basically like really light stuff. I would believe it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been, you know, just focusing on crazy shit lately. So it got me thinking about simulation games and, you know, just like this whole genre of like sim games. Cause a lot of times when like the world gets kind of thrown in like chaos or something happens, I kind of like going back to the simulation games. Like kind of like you were talking earlier, you're playing that like kind of like a zoo sim that you're really enjoying. And there's something about the, I don't know, like the tasks and sort of the management of it that keeps me good. Like when I blew out my knee a couple years ago and I had to have surgery. And during my surgery, I pretty much just played Stardew Valley, like over and over. Like that's all I did. I was listening to audiobooks and like laying on the couch trying to like heal my knee and just playing Stardew Valley. And it was really healing for me. Like it kept things really calm. So anyway, I've been thinking about simulation games. And then I realized that this year is the 20th year anniversary of The Sims. And I love a good anniversary, obviously.
Yeah, right? Stories. Two like, out of two.
Yeah, I love a good anniversary. Anniversary is like, all right, we should be recognizing this as a historical moment. And so I thought I would do an entry on Will Wright. He's the creator of The Sims. And he's like, he's just a really super interesting guy who's got like a really deep interest in psychology. And he turned a traumatic loss into the best-selling PC game of all time. So he's...
Wait, is that The Sims? Is that the best PC-selling games of all time? No way!
Or it's like, it might have... I don't know in the last year if it like got overtaken or not, but I'm pretty sure it's the best PC-selling franchise
of all time. I'm so happy to hear that. That makes me happy. Yes, it's such a good game. Oh my God.
The Sims is so fun. Did you play The Sims growing up?
Oh, I played so much of The Sims. My dad was in line at Walmart to get me The Sims on launch day when I was at school. So,
wow.
Yeah, I was.
You must have been pretty young.
I was pretty young. It came out in
2000s.
Yeah. So in 2000, I was in high school. Second or third year of high school. Yeah. And I was really into video games, but not like pro yet or anything, but
right,
you know, I really wanted this so much, and I've talked about it for months ahead because there's trailers and we got like books and stuff, and my dad surprised me that night when he came back from work with a copy of The Sims. So
that's so exciting. And The Sims is such like a great you know, game for formative years, like, you know, you being in high school, like that's such a perfect time to play that game. I was in college and like I loved The Sims. Like that was one of the few games I actually had on my computer. But Sim City was a game that I played like when I was in high school. And it's interesting because like I played Sim City and I didn't know who Will Wright was, but I do remember thinking that Will Wright was the first game developer I really knew by name.
Oh, I think so too.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah, there was like a lot of features on him, right? Like little featurettes or like the news. Maybe would cover with him like MTV or something.
Miyamoto? Maybe like, well, no, I probably learned of Miyamoto later. So I think you're right.
Will Wright's name was never on the box of The Sims because a lot of times, like, you know, artists and directors and stuff don't get credit in the same way as like musicians, for example, because there's like such a big team that goes with it. So like, even though he might be the figurehead of it, like he wasn't necessarily like on the box. So I don't know exactly why I knew of him by name, but I remember just knowing of him and
oh, you're right.
Before I really understood the gaming industry, you know?
I think me too.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And have you ever met Will Wright ever in your
That's kind of crazy that you're asking me this. No, I have not. But I've worked with people that worked with them at Ubisoft. So like people that worked on The Sims and Spores with them moved to Ubisoft Montreal, and then I work with them. So they worked on games with Will Wright. But
so like first, like like 1 degree.
Yeah, like, I'm like one degree kind of friends with them, you know?
No big deal. You're like basically besties. Like,
what about you? Have you ever met them?
I've never met him. No, I've never met him. Like, he's a legend though. I mean, because he's kind of like, he's an artist, you know, and he really cares about the psychology of everything. So I remember playing SimCity, and but I played the SimCity 2000, which was like the second version of SimCity. We had an Apple computer, and I would come home like every day after school just to play that game. Like that, like 1993 was a really big like computer game. Like I think Myst came out that year, and I got really into Myst like later on. And so like SimCity and Myst were really big, and I would play like a politician, like managing a city. And they had these like civic and urban renewal projects like that you kind of had to do. Like, did you play SimCity or did you only play this? You played SimCity. So there's all these
SimCity 2000 and 3000, I think. But I was young, right?
You were, must have been really young. Yeah.
Yeah. I was in primary schools when I played those. Yeah.
But it's interesting because it's like, here you are in primary school or even in high school and playing a game about urban development.
Yeah, I know, right? Being like,
and managing, you know, the city. And also, like, I was in high school. I was, like, rushing to get home to sit down at a computer that's like, let's manage city stuff and health problems and taxes. And, like, and I was like, yeah, like, I don't need to, like, relax or something after school. Just want to jump right into taxes. But, like, they had these, like, doom scenarios, too, where, like, you had to you know, like there was like UFO stuff, like where UFOs would come and like take over the city, or like or a fire or an earthquake, or like you just had to solve like unemployment issues or something. But I would do that sometimes. And it really, I would say like in those years of being a high schooler, it really captured my imagination. And it made me realize that I could manage a city, or that I could make myself think that way. There was a enjoyment, like a pleasure that I got in interacting with a video game this way. And I really think that this was probably the most interactive game that I had played that really demanded more of me beyond like save the princess or have like be able to make this jump. It was more about testing like my own morality at times, like if I wanted to destroy my city, or empathy that I had with the characters, the people who lived in my city.
Wait, oh my God, I've never thought about this.
It's interesting, right?
I've always wanted to kind of quote unquote beat the game, like save my city. I never really tried to like destroy it.
Oh, yeah.
That's so cool. Well, I'm such a weird human sometimes. Like for me, it doesn't even imagine, like I can't even conceive that people would do bad deeds.
Right. Because you can, if you put the doom scenario on your city, like you could wipe your city out, or you could play it and you might not win. I forget what I don't know what they were called. Like it was an expansion, like a scenario thing. You could just, you know, people had, it's kind of like what his whole God mode thing is. Like he, you know, the simulation game kind of puts you in the place of like God over these characters. And some people really love that. Like this is like a big genre in gaming that people are like super into. And it really does, like at times for healing, at least I think, kind of cool to play it when you're in a time of transition or in a time of healing. It really kind of just keeps you doing the sort of repetitive human tasks. But I was also like kind of an obsessive kid, and Will Wright actually describes himself as obsessive. He said as a child, he was very obsessive. He told the San Francisco Chronicle, I would usually get very obsessed with some subject or area of interest for 6 months or a year and just totally learn everything I could about it. So he would just throw himself into it, even as a kid. And it's important to know that that Will Wright actually got a really unique education as a kid, and actually later in life too. But instead of regular elementary school, like, I don't know how everybody does school around the world, but there's, you know, here we usually have, like, you know, elementary, then like junior high, and then high school, or middle school and high school, right? And so he, instead of going to regular elementary school, went to this thing called a Montessori school.
Okay.
In Atlanta, Georgia. And I've heard of these growing up before, but I didn't really understand what it was until I started really researching it here. But a Montessori school, it doesn't do grades or tests. It doesn't measure education in the same way. It's like a highly creative space that emphasizes independence and freedom by encouraging discovery through, like, they'll give them, you know, items like blocks or whatever, and let them use intuition and interaction to educate them on how to use a tool or to how to interact with their environment. And he says in an interview with the New Yorker, he says, the Montessori taught me the joy of discovery. It's all about learning on your own terms rather than a teacher explaining stuff to you. SimCity comes right out of Montessori. If you give people this model for building cities, they will abstract from it principles of urban design, which is kind of crazy. I mean, like, it is
crazy.
It's true. Cause, like, you know, you really did, like, there was no instructions really that come with the Sims or like SimCity. I mean, you know, your basic system, which is like, you have to keep the city safe, or you have to keep your Sims fed, or, you know, their happiness meters up. So, you know, you have to do that, but there's not really like,
there's no goal. Yeah, you're right.
And so it's really about you creating with the game. And this is something that's really important to him as like a cornerstone. And it's actually like just a really beautiful theory, I think, the way that he looks at things. Like, he's got such a cool education that makes him like really open and about like the experimental connection between the player themselves and the game, you know, that you're really programming as you go and creating as you go as the player. So anyway, that's sort of like where his basis is, right?
Yeah.
So around it, which he's so lucky to have this education, to be quite honest, because not everybody, it's true that when you go to school, sometimes I would have loved an environment like that personally. I don't know about you, but I kind of thrive in that. At the same time though, I do like to have like measurements for success, you know, and it's interesting because it feels like it takes out the measurement of success, which is probably healthier.
Yeah, but then because you can probably create your own measurement of success and you're not pressured by society to fit that mold, especially for like potentially kids that can't fit the mold. They're different. Like, everyone's different. Society probably conglomerates like one system that supports most of us, but it's not. It, like, I've talked about this maybe with you before, but like, not someone that can fit into a 9-to-5.
Yeah.
I cannot fit into a 9-to-5. And there's research that shows that actually 2/3 of the people can't fit in a 9-to-5.
I can't either.
For society to function, all of us have to fit in a 9-to-5. So I'm glad that we're able to have different career paths now, especially with COVID, where I don't have to fit in that 9-to-5 anymore to function, or else I wouldn't function, right? I just would be always depressed. So I think it's very, very interesting. And I think it speaks for the future of schooling too. I don't know about you guys, how it's evolving in the US, but I think in Canada, we're trying to push students to not be in that mold anymore, but try to like what's important right now to learn in schools is to learn how to adapt, how to problem solve, how to learn continuously through your whole life. It's not about knowing dates. It's not about knowing, you know, like stuff that you learn and then you'll forget in a week. It's about like the processes, right? And I feel that that school, for real, right, is about the process to get to point A to B. But sometimes you can go to C to Z. It doesn't matter. It's the journey that matters, right? So it's for me, it's the future of workers. It's not the future of workers. It's the current, like, successful workers are already thinking that way.
Absolutely.
But it's the future of education, where I think It should be what how we educate students and people and society.
I totally agree. You know, he actually talks a lot about how school he really sees changing as gamers become teachers.
Because he says that
you know, it's people who really understand processes differently, how to interact. So he's like a really big advocate for like shaking up the way we learn. You know?
I love it.
And yeah, and like it's crazy because he actually like went to the school for the other thing too is this school was developed by a woman in Italy. And it's named after her. Her last name is Montessori. And so yeah, it was sort of put all over the world, actually. Other people sort of started popping up these schools where kind of followed her methods. Like she's got it's really, really cool. But anyway, so he really flourished in this school and he's like, you know, doing great. And he makes things, he's got into like making robots at 13 in like the early 1970s. He started getting curious about robots. So he gave an interview with Rolling Stone magazine that said that the very first robot he ever created had a little hydraulic arm made entirely out of injection syringes. He was 13. And so he's like creating robots pretty young and really enjoys like working with his hands and building things. And he's got really supportive parents. Both of his mom and dad like really encourage him to like think big, think outside the box, think about space, you know, outside of like our own world. And you know, sadly though, his dad passed away when he was just 9 years old of leukemia. So he lost his father figure really early on, tragically. Mm-hmm. And his mother had to move them back home to where she was from, which was Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I guess at the time she was an actress and an amateur magician, which is fascinating. I would love to ask him like what that was like growing up with a mom who could do magic tricks for you. Like that sounds so cool.
That is so random.
Yeah.
I love like, it. I remember buying magician magazines with like stuff. But I never got deep into it. So I've always really passionated by people that do.
There was a magic shop in Pike Place Market in Seattle. And we would go to Seattle and we'd beg our parents to like, please take us to the magic shop so that we could go in, like had like all of the little, you know, like whoopee cushions and stuff, but you know, I had everything that, and by the way, like why is a whoopee cushion like always in a magic shop? Like it's not really magic.
Yeah,
it's just a, you know, but it's always there. And like, that was always the one thing my parents were like, yeah, that's fine. You know, like, it's the cheapest thing.
Buy that plastic thing.
I love magicians though. So I think that's really cool that his mom did that, but she moves them back home. And sadly they took him out of, they didn't have a Montessori school. So they put him in an Episcopalian prep school, which couldn't be like any different from what he was doing. Like that's a college prep school. That's religious, that, you know, and he wasn't like, he didn't love that. And he wasn't like a religious kid, and kind of realized like during that time that, that he was an atheist. Like, so it was a pretty young age. He was like really questioning.
Self-aware. Yeah.
Yeah. Questioning the world, questioning God. And it's interesting to me that he, you know, realized he was an atheist so early on and then went on to make games that are like this God.
Yeah. God
genre.
Mode.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't believe in gods. I believe we can be our own gods.
Yeah. It's interesting. Especially what he's doing later in life, which I'll tell you too. But so at 16 years old, he like leaves the prep school and he goes to college and he goes to Louisiana State University and Louisiana Tech. And he's going toward an architecture degree and he's going toward like mechanical engineering. And he, at the time though, he really wasn't loving it. And so he told the New Yorker, there's this really great, feature on Will Wright in the New Yorker from like 2006. It's called Game Master. It's awesome article. And he told the New Yorker, he said, I excelled only in subjects that I was interested in: architecture, economics, mechanical engineering, and military history. It said that he had impractical goals. In addition to starting colonies in space, he wanted to build robots. So he just, like, this was a guy that cannot really be constrained mm-hmm. by the typical school system. He's so imaginative and so expansive. So he decided this wasn't jiving with him. So in 1980, he dropped out and moved to New York and lived in Greenwich Village, which is like, if I lived in New York City, it would be like the place I want to live. And it's just very cool music history area of New York, very hippie, and it's just super cool. So he started to attend school, university at the New School for Robotics in New York. And that, that university is highly respected. It's like, it's all like artsy, and it features student directed curriculum. So it doesn't require undergrads to take general course like the way you do in regular school. Instead, it sort of expects the students to be the primary designers of their own individualized education. So each of them sort of have a hand in building what their major is, how they're working toward it. It's like, so it's much more now back into like the Will Wright.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, he's like, I got to get back to that. So anyway, he gets back to like taking, you know, school that makes him think a little bit more outside the box. And he's building robots, you know, he's like in this like cool, you know, 70 or like 1980, like robot crew in New York. And his friend is like, you should get an Apple II because like you managing your robots and you should have this computer. So he bought an Apple II because he was into robots, not because he was into video games, but that kind of came later. That's how he got the computer. So anyway, it's kind of a theme for Will Wright to be in these like imaginative education environments, empowering students to have the freedom to learn and the freedom to build. And like through that kind of really finding a desire to understand the human condition, because he has taken psychology classes this entire time too. So he didn't graduate though. He got like 5 years of college and then he was like, and he fell in love with a girl. And one summer he met a girl and he fell in love with her madly. And decided to just quit what he was doing and move to California to be with her.
Oh.
And they were together. So with a computer that he originally bought for his robotics career, he decided to try his hand at making his own game. And in an interview with VentureBeat, Will said, "My first couple of games I did all by myself. I did the art, I did the sound, the music, the graphics, everything." And his first game was called Raid on Bungling Bay, and it was released on PC in 1984. And I actually had this game. It was like a little helicopter on an airstrip in the middle of like water, and it would make just this little helicopter noise, and you could go around to the different islands and like take out the factories. And I had no idea how to play this game when I was a kid, so I just know that you add the first
Will Wright game that he made all by himself.
Yeah. Well, like our neighbor also like gave us discs all the time and gave us, he just always was like the video game neighbor guy that was super into computers. So it was from the discarded pile.
That's what
he's just like here giving us stuff. And I had no idea what it was, but I, when I looked up a video of it, I was like, oh my God, like I didn't even know that's what the goal was. I just know that I just put the helicopter and like hit a building. So I was so young. So apparently though, as the game moves on, these factories that you would take out as the helicopter, they would evolve. Like they would grow and it would like learn technology. So like it would shoot, not lasers, but it would shoot something at you. I've never seen the upgraded version of it, but it would take you down. So like almost like an RTS, you know, how like buildings upgrade and whatever. So it had that. And what he realized, the game released, he was able to sell it. And it was on PC, but in the next year, he was able to get it on Nintendo. And it sold 1 million copies in Japan, actually. So his very first game he ever made, this like ridiculous, like
factory destroying.
Yeah, thing. It's just like a helicopter shoot 'em up kind of thing. It's just a weird little game. But that like helicopter thing was big though too. There was like another game called Choplifter that was like cool helicopter game in the day. So I don't know. It must be like
a trend.
The war thing, you know, from earlier on, like that's how they were making games. I don't know. So anyhow, he made his first game and he sold a million copies of it. Even if it was in Japan, like he sold so many of it that he was able to make a good little living off of it. And in that time, it inspired him to make SimCity, because he tells the San Francisco Chronicle, he says, I had to create the landscape with islands and little roads and buildings for you to bomb. And I found out that I was more interested in creating the buildings on the island than in blowing them up. So he just liked making them and populating this universe, this environment. So Will makes the first SimCity, and he can't get anyone interested in publishing it. He's doing it all on his own. He's pitching it around, but it's not a game that anyone can win. So it was just something that like publishers weren't interested in. They didn't get it. They were like, why play a game doing like mundane real life stuff when, you know, managing taxes in a city when you could be defeating like big bads and becoming a hero, you know? So he retired the idea to a shelf in an office basement, and he just kind of forgot about it because everybody told him that they didn't understand it. And he kind of like faces that problem a lot. And I think that comes from his education in being somebody who's like really imaginative and expansive as a thinker, and kind of coming out to people who just want it to fit into a certain mold and aren't really seeing what he's trying to create and bring into the world, which is much different than what the road a lot of other developers had taken at that time. So anyway, he kind of forgot about it. And then he got invited to this party, and it was like a game developer party in 1986. And they gave him free beer and pizza, and there was a bunch of game developers there, and there was a young entrepreneur guy there, and his name was Jeff Braun. And Jeff like really wanted to get into video games. He's like, how do I crack into this space? I like it. I want to be in it. So he talked to his friend, who was like, well, let's put together a party and I'll just invite all the game developers I know. So they like had a little like meet and greet, like get to know you session. And he saw, Jeff saw Will like just kind of chilling and being sort of quiet and in the corner, not really saying much. So he struck up a conversation, and like 2 hours in, these guys were like best friends. He's explaining SimCity to him, and Jeff sees it. He gets it. And he's like, this is exactly what I was looking for. This is exactly the kind of thinking that I want. So soon after that, the two of them decided to go into business together, and they formed a company called Maxis Studios.
Ah, so I have shivers.
They just, right?
That's so cool.
And then like, cause here he was like, just thinking like, no one understands my thought process. No one understands what I'm giving. And here's this guy who's like, let's do this. So exciting. So the first SimCity was released in 1989, and it was like popular right off the bat. People were really into it, and it made Will and Jeff millions. I mean, it even took their firm public. They were on the stock market, and they had pretty high stock prices. So they were like doing it, you know? And then they released the SimCity 2000 game, which we played. And that was like in 1993. But so now he's got like this SimCity thing going on. He'd made other like little Sims too, by the way. Like he had an ant sim and this earth sim thing. Like, so the simulation thing was something he was really inspired by. But like that, once he got the city thing down, that was really something that people could grasp, because they're like, I'm not gonna like sim ant or whatever. Like, you know, he was like trying to like just figure it out, you know?
Sim ants, I still can't get over it. Oh my God. That guy is so awesome. Okay.
He's so funny. He's so funny. I love that he's like Sim Ant is what I, because he wanted to understand the behaviors of ants and like kind of just see how similar they can be to people, actually.
So he just made the game.
Yeah. He just was like, okay. So it was during this time of like the early 90s, specifically 1991, that Will had this huge success, but ended up having like a really terrible tragedy happened in his life. His house burns down in a California wildfire, which I didn't really know about him until like a couple months ago when I was reading about him. And I don't know how much like the rest of the world follows what the wildfires here in California. Like, I live by them, and they're scary and they're destructive and they're only getting worse. And when this podcast drops on Tuesday, it's only going to be 2 weeks ago since 90,000 people in Irvine, which is like Disneyland area, were evacuated when the fire spread to 7,200 acres and came just mere miles to Blizzard Entertainment. So hundreds of employees and game developers at Blizzard Entertainment were given mandatory evacuation orders in the middle of a pandemic, like during this crazy election time, while they're trying to put out a major expansion for World of Warcraft next month. So just like such a crazy high amount of stress. And like, there's a tweet I wanted to pull up, Danny. I don't know if you can pull it up, but just so like you guys get an idea, Adam Fletcher, who works over at Blizzard, put this map up that really showed like that little black box right there is yeah. where Blizzard is.
Oh, wow.
And the red area was mandatory evacuation. The yellow area was optional evacuation, but people left because it was really scary. And he's like, if you want to know how close these evacuations are and why Blizzard employees have been posting about it all day, the black box is the Blizzard campus in relation to the zones. So like, it was scary. Like, I was on Twitter, like watching my friends, like leaving their homes and like having to figure out where to stay in the middle of everything going on with their animals and like a car loaded with stuff. Like, it just, it's wild.
I mean, we follow it, but honestly, we've been kind of more aware of it in the last 2 years. I think before
in the last
that,
2 years,
it wasn't hitting us like it is now. I think last year was pretty bad, and this year we get it with what happened in Australia as well.
The Australian one.
Yeah. So like the whole thing is crazy to me. That
it's wild.
That if that happened here, I feel that we would be fighting all year long to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I feel that as soon as the fires are out, the story is over and we kind of move on in the news. In the US. So I'm kind of sad that we're not taking climate change seriously.
Yeah, it's yeah. I mean, climate change is so severe. And you know, and people, like, if you don't live near it, you know, it's hard to see it. But the fires are happening like every single year, multiple times a year, burning down millions of acres. And this year alone, California suffered four of its largest fires ever recorded, ever, of all time. Like, the four biggest ones were this year. So climate change is really serious and scary. And the Oakland firestorm in 1991 wasn't the biggest fire acreage-wise that Will's house burned in, but it was it's still the third deadliest California fire in history. 25 people lost their lives in that. And Will's experience was detailed in the New Yorker piece. It says, one morning in 1991, as Will awoke in his house in the Oakland Hills, he thought he smelled smoke and called 911. Over the next half hour, the smoke got worse. I thought, this is not trending well. And he and his wife decided it was time to evacuate. So they grabbed some family photos, jumped in the car, and drove away. Their daughter was at a friend's house. And so when they returned 3 days later, after they could actually go into the area, the Oakland Hills firestorm had destroyed everything. It's called the Tunnel Fire officially from Cal Fire, because that's the street it started on. But nothing was left except for like some lumps of melted metal and the remains of their other car. Like, they lost it's something I truly am afraid of because of the area I live in. Like, I can't even fathom losing my home.
Yeah.
In a
and
fire.
And everything in it. How do you recover from that, you know?
And like, that's, I think, the thing that really drew me to Will Wright's story was because how he turned this into rebuilding. You know, thankfully, that's kind of what he excels at. He loves architecture. He loves building. And, you know, in the months that followed, as he went about replacing his belongings, he started thinking about all the things people need in their houses. And he said, I hate to shop, and I was forced to buy all these things, from toothpaste, utensils, and socks up to furniture. So in ways, it was like starting from scratch in stocking up a doll's house. And that really inspired him as the basis for The Sims, because here he was really understanding the tools and the resources that you live with and what your relationship is with each of those items. So he starts sort of cataloging this and thinking about it. And he also started reading three pivotal writings and books that helped him understand how he could sort of turn this house burning experience into like a positive game in some way. So he credits these three books in like every single interview he ever, ever, ever does. So like literally at least one of them are mentioned in every single article I've ever read. So they're super important to him just as a person. The first one is called Pattern Language by an architect named Christopher Alexander. And it helped Will learn how architecture can enhance or reduce a person's sense of freedom. So it's about creating satisfying living spaces and the idea that architecture can be measured by the happiness of the people who live in it, which I think is fascinating because I also really love like home design, and like I really take a lot of pride in like redecorating or, you know, redoing parts of our home. And I really, that really resonates with me, because that is, architecture really is like it, there's a certain way that you feel in your home and in your space. And like, if it really is a place that you love, like you're happy, and it's like your happy safe space, you know?
I don't know if you know that I made my, my bachelor in architecture.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's kind of crazy that, Will Wright's past is architecture, and then he became a game designer. But, bachelor in architecture. And I always say that for me, when people tell me you come from architecture and you made games, like why, like what's the connection? I always say for me, a game designer is a game architect. Like how I see it is like when you're an architect, it's about the user's experience and how they live and feel in the space that you create for them, how they move, how they interact, how they how the flow of the environment from night to day, the weather and whatnot interacts with that space so that users can be comfortable in it. And for me, the video games is the same, but the player's experience, what they feel, what they go through, their journey, etc. So for me, it's exactly the same thing from the building.
It's a framework.
To the game, right? So yeah. I find it fascinating that one of his favorite book is an architecture game.
Did you read that one at all? Are you familiar with that one at all? Pattern Language?
I think I might have it.
It's said that like decades later, this book is on the wiki for this book. It said that like decades later, it's still one of the most popular books in architecture.
I think I might have it. I have like my box of architecture books that's like closet right here. I'm interested to see if I have it. If not, if I do, I think I'm going to go back to it. Yeah.
Oh man, we have to have Will Wright on this episode. I wonder if he would come on our show. I would die if he did, but like, it would be so cool to hear you guys talk about it. It's really awesome. He has like another one too. The second book, Inspiration, came from a psychologist named Abraham Maslow. It's a 1943 paper called A Theory of Human Motivation. And it describes a pyramid-shaped hierarchy of human needs. So physiological is the bottom, and then it's like safety, love, esteem, and at the very top is self-actualization.
Did you learn that in school?
I remember learning about that psychology class or something.
We learn about the Maslow pyramid in regular high school here. It's not even really? It's like just the regular like.
Oh, I definitely learned that in an elective. I have an American school, and they don't like to teach anything to do with the way the world actually works. Safety, love.
Yeah, no, I remember learning that in like really, really young. You had to learn the pyramids and the basic needs of humans. So yeah,
you have like a good foundation. As like I feel like as I was reading about his education and just like his readings, I was felt like inspired to want to like read the things that he has because.
But you know, I actually started a psychology degree online last year.
So, really?
Yes, it's something that we can do here. You should look into it.
Yeah.
And it was a certificate, and I took like a couple of classes online. I never finished it because life gets busy and whatnot.
Yeah, but yeah.
I still like you know, unlike when you're in school when you're young, there's no downsides of like not finishing a degree.
But right.
Like I still feel that I learned, and I really enjoyed doing the paperwork, and it was a totally different experience than when I did my studies when I was young. So you should.
Right.
You should look online classes and these kind of things.
Maybe I will.
Yeah. It's
maybe really I will get like, yeah, do it. Cause I mean, everything's online anyway. Might as well.
Exactly.
It's fascinating.
And you can just take one class a semester. It's not like you have to go like crazy. Like
I'll be able to really throw some like real gems at my therapist. She'll be like, wait, what? I'm like, I know this now.
Yeah.
I know it's what this behavior is.
To my mom and my dad when I was six.
So why I'm crazy is, yeah, she'll be like, okay, the work is done. He's got a third one too, a psychology book called Maps of the Mind by Charles Hampton Turner. And it compares more than 50 theories about how the mind works. And he's brought this one up in several interviews. I've not heard of this one.
Yeah, me neither.
At all. No. But he brought it up in a really great interview by GameStudies.org. They interviewed him and he handed the book to the interviewer and was like, here, you can just thumb through it. He just kept saying, thumb through it. It's got like a picture and like a way that you think. It's fascinating. I was going to try to look it up on like Amazon or something.
You just brought the book, you know. I'm that kind of person. When I talk to you, I get interviews, I just bring my books. Like I could just display props as I talk.
So happiness in living spaces, a hierarchy of human needs, and how the mind works by fusing these three concepts together. He developed the model for which to score the happiness of people in his dollhouse by their status, popularity, and success, and by the quality of the environment that the player designs for them. So like the more comfortable the house, the happier the people. So these are all coming directly out of the books that he was reading about architecture and human behavior. So in the early mid 90s, he's releasing SimCity 2000. And by the way, that like disaster scenario thing I was telling you about earlier.
Yeah.
It recreates real life events. And he programmed the Oakland firestorm of 1991 into the disaster of the game, how he lost his house. And there's dialogue in the game that says like, you know, the fire is by Will's house. Like he put that in the game. Isn't that crazy?
So good. These are the little things that really makes me happy. That is
and like
awesome.
When I was a teenager playing that game, like I didn't know that this was a game designer, like drawing on his own life experience. It's fascinating. So SimCity 2000, Wired did an interview with Will in 1994 and he ended the interview. Like he was talking about SimCity and like evolving and the interviewer was really asking him about like, you know, his future in the Sims. And he was like, I've had enough of the Sims life and I'm not, you know, it's just very like, I'm done. No siree. Like I'm not into it. Like he told them. And then at the very end of the article, he goes, I'm hoping to strike out in a slightly different direction moving forward. I have in mind a game I want to call Dollhouse. And it gives grownups some tools to design what is basically a dollhouse, but a dollhouse for adults may not be very marketable. That's how he ended it. Like, so here he was,
so
like really
huge
floating
teaser of what was coming.
The
up.
Sims. Oh yeah. Cause this was 1994, New Year's Day, 1994. So he like 6 years later, the game was coming out, but he's working on this dollhouse design thing. And that was exactly the problem. Again, like just like with SimCity, he cannot convince people to like understand why this is cool, why it makes sense, including his own board of directors. So he took it to Maxis and his partner, Jeff. And Jeff recalls to that New Yorker piece, he was recalling that that even the board looked at him and looked at the Sims and was like, what is this? Like, he wants to do an interactive dollhouse? Like, the guy's out of his mind. Like, dollhouses are for girls. And girls don't play video games, Stephanie.
I'm pissed.
Girls don't play video games. We don't exist. Like, so that is like, that was their thinking in like the mid 90s that like, that women weren't interested in games. Which is why, and that was like kind of at a height of like a marketing era of like Blue Isle, Pink Isle, whatever. Yeah. So, you know, they had to sort of like classify it, but it's just interesting that that it was just assumed that women didn't like games just because they decided not to market them to women. It's just, it's fascinating. So Will himself remembers in retrogamer.net, he said, when I was describing it to Maxis, even with the focus on the people, they were just hearing the game about taking out the trash and cleaning out your bathroom. And it just didn't sound very interesting to them compared to like saving the world or like flying a fighter jet. So he persisted, knowing it was something he needed to make, because he said, I kind of understood that people were fascinated with people. And I knew that it was interesting to me. And if I knew that was interesting to me, I kind of had to fight for it internally. And at first, no one was behind the project. We had some programmers, he said, who were in a tool group and weren't using them. So I turned them into a black box project on the side and said, can I have these four programmers? And nobody really cared. They were just like, yeah, go ahead. But so he starts like working on it, and they finally got the game to a point where they could give it to a focus group. And the focus group were even like, they were testing out five different game concepts for it. And he says, I remember the other four focus testers, when we were describing the idea to them, they were all universally like, this is such a bad idea. Like, this is so dumb. We would never play this game. Totally bombed in their focus groups. And Will always says that he just continued to believe in the concept, even if people didn't understand it. So he took the secret team of programmers and set about creating an early part of the simulation. And, you know, because it had like a female thing to it, like people just didn't really, they didn't care, and they didn't understand how they saw it as female, and they couldn't win. How alpha is that? like, calm down. So another issue that Will dealt with in getting The Sims off the ground was from the narrative point of view, because he had strong feelings on this across nearly every interview too. And to GamesBeat, he said, I think games and stories are two sides of the same coin. The best stories I've ever experienced or heard of in games were the players' stories themselves and the things that uniquely happened to each person in what they did, which I feel like is, I mean, what we're kind of talking about on the podcast, right?
This is our
like,
podcast.
So I love Will Wright. Like, it's just perfect. So he quietly built the game, and in 1997, Electronic Arts bought his company, Maxis. The company, like, couldn't really stay afloat. They needed to figure out. So they bought it, and they loved the dollhouse idea, and they were like, I think we can figure out a way to make this work, even though they're kind of known for sports franchises at that time. They saw it, and they understood it. And a really interesting little side fact here, when they sold the company, he received $17 million in EA stock for his share of the company. Wow. Like, that's crazy. In 1997. So I don't know like what the adjustment for that is, but it's a lot. So after losing his house and like losing everything he had, you know, was able to really create another success off of something that people just didn't understand.
Okay, there's so many things that are so puzzling. First of all, I was wondering if EA bought Maxis before or after The Sims. So you right just before. Solved that. And also I'm so puzzled that EA decided to go ahead with it, because they're usually not really – like, from the outside, I've never worked at EA, obviously, but from the outside, they're not really the risk taker company, no. right? They usually go for new IP, too difficult, like, you know. So it's kind of awesome that they believed in this project.
They saw it. They did see it, and they had the money to fund it. So he was able to, like, revamp it and getting to do it. But, you know, he said, he was like, I'm done with the Sims thing. They were like, yeah, we like the Sims franchise name, and you've sold a lot, so we're gonna call it The Sims. Like, so it was decided, like, it was gonna stay The Sims. And it released in February of 2000 and became an instant success, becoming the best selling PC game of all time, earning more to date than $5 billion. Here's that little idea, and now it's $5 billion later.
Let me Google. I want to see if the Sims covers was pink. Just curious.
There's so many Sims. Like, that's kind of what
the
was.
The original cover box.
Oh, the original cover? I don't know.
It's all colors. It has, like, yellow, blue, red, green, purple, So they just went everywhere.
Just like old game boxes. Like people love that. So it made a lot of money, which is definitely one of the most important things. But it also welcomed girls into video game marketing. Girls obviously, you know, played video games before, but, you know, because companies were, you know, marketing to the boys, you know, women just didn't see it. So suddenly women were like all over this game and like a huge part of the player base. And to Will Wright, he's like, didn't really surprise him because 40% of his development team was women. So he's always had women around him as part of growing up, you know, and, you know, he had his daughter who was also like 14 years old. Her name's Cassidy, which is a cute name. She's probably like my age now, who knows, but she would play test with him and he would watch her and her friends play the game and would notice that she would get more into like the creative mode than she would in the, you know, the goal oriented side. So that really taught him as well, because he said he never played with dolls as a kid. Like he was more like into like building model trains and like ships and, you know, stuff like that. But he thought of SimCity even as a train set that you could make in the video game. That's how he saw it in his head. So he never played with dolls. So he really got to like understand this and understand that it kind of transforms the tactile experience of playing with dolls that had been a part of children's development for thousands of years into a virtual experience. So this is something that's like very innate to us to do. But The Sims, you know, obviously it's grown into like multiple sequels and expansions and, you know, has had collaborators like with like Katy Perry, who did Sims 3 Showtime Collector's Expansion Pack. And truth be told, that was the very first like official video game review I did when I was working for HelloGiggles.com. A friend of mine was working for Fangoria doing reviews and brought me into 47 Communications, which is like a PR thing. And this guy named Blake Schuster, who I'm still friends with, gave me a copy of that for me to review. So I totally reviewed it and it was fun. And I had never done that. Like I had talked about games myself, but not like, hey, please review this for us. So I had like more responsibility, but, but yeah, so like, you know, it's an interesting game because The Sims, you know, it's a game that like lacks all narrative and wasn't actually at some point, you know, even though it lacks narrative, it even had like a movie deal. Like Fox, 20th Century Fox had bought the rights to The Sims to do a movie like a couple years ago. And they were moving forward on it. But when Disney bought the assets from 20th Century Fox, it canceled the project. Oh. I'd be really curious to know like what that narrative would be like for The Sims.
There's so many angles they can take. I want that movie. Are you God like playing or are you like a Sim? Like, oh my God. I want that movie.
It goes so many ways with it, right?
Come on, Disney.
Most recently with The Sims, that was really kind of, you know, out of the box was this summer. They did a competition. They did not an esport, but like a, you know, a competitive gaming thing on TBS with the E-League guys. And it's called Sim Sparks. And 12 contestants were selected and tasked with challenges in The Sims 4 to create characters and stories based on the given theme, with the winner taking home $100,000. And I've never thought of The Sims as a competitive game, but it was actually, I watched an episode of it and I was like, this is actually really fun and creative and inspiring to like kids who are watching it, who want to feel like what they create matters, you know? It's cool. Just something different.
It's really cool. I know my colleague at CLG Summer, she saw that and she was like, that's a game I would compete in, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really fun for me to see that.
It opens up our definitions for that, you know, and like, and I really, and you and I think have talked about this before, like, but you know, it's nice when esports is able to like open up and accept new people and see new ways of doing things while still protecting what it has built and made the entire time. So as for Will, he has gone on to create and develop Spore, of course, which is a whole other thing, but Spore, I'm sure a lot of you have played it. I'm sure you've played it.
Yeah.
And before leaving EA, No, I guess he created Spore before leaving EA. He was 12 years at the company, but then he left and he created his own thing called Stupid Fun Club. And he just was trying to, like, you know, do like multimedia projects and whatnot. His own website for Stupid Fun Club notes that Will has been given a couple of really cool awards, including the 100 People Changing America from Rolling Stone. He won the first ever Gamer God Award at the Spike Video Game Awards. And in 2007, he got a BAFTA for achievement in video games. He also got a PGA, like Producers Guild Award, the Vanguard Award, which is really cool. So GamesDaily.biz observes, it takes a special kind of creativity to make millions of people fall in love with city planning and life simulations. Will Wright's work on SimCity, The Sims, and Spore have engaged players' creative minds and built thriving communities that have spanned years and console generations. I really love Will's earnest approach to game design, and he describes it as dealing with two things. We're dealing with the computer in front of you and the player's mind. The player's mind is the other thing we're programming, and that's the much more mysterious, deeper, tricky one to program. How to understand that computer and how to learn efficiently from it. And in some ways, it's a little edgy to think about programming the player's mind. And I watched a really great interview that Jeff Keighley did with him for the 2019 E3 Coliseum. And Will talks in depth about his new project that he's doing called Proxy, which is all about building your actual memories into the gameplay experience via AI simulation. So you would like tell them what your memory is and then they would create it. So then you could send your avatar out into this world that would then interact with other avatars. Like we could both upload our memories to our own avatars and then they could communicate. But who knows if they would get along, if there would be a problem, what memories are shared, and I'm sure they're like all in these beginning stages. It is a little like sci-fi to think about.
I'll play anything he does. So,
but I'm not surprised that he's doing it. Yeah. I'm not surprised that he's like doing this work. He says by uploading personal and private moments, the AI will start to send your avatar into the world to interact with other avatar of other people. And it's really wild and clearly where things are headed from an experimental standpoint. He was slated to speak at GDC about it this year. According to Gamasutra, his talk was going to fill everyone in on Proxy and examine why human memory is bizarre. And it's a thing that rarely works the way we think it do, with the way we think it does. And also discusses why he's convinced that we can use memories to reverse engineer and reconstruct the subconscious id inside of each of us, uncovering the real person that we have a sense of but may have never met. So Will Wright has always been on the edge of something new, something that we haven't ever thought about before, like applying game theory to human behavior and studying our own species through it, which seems like exactly Will Wright and exactly where he is right now is interesting. But that's my entry for Will Wright. He's on Twitter at Stupid Fun Will, but he doesn't really tweet anything, so you can really find him.
What an episode. I'm so excited. I'm so happy you did it on Will Wright.
I'm glad. It's fascinating how it connects to you.
Yeah, being Will Wright was like a dream for me at some point, you know? I don't know if it's something that I'll come back to game design, but, you know, to see the people that never left and that have like 40 years of game design, from like Becky to Will, you know, it makes me think, did I do a mistake going into esports? I don't think so, but, you know, I feel that there's this desire of me every day, the things I need to, like, I'm not done with the game design.
You can totally come back to it. And, you know, you were able to use the younger years to do esports, like, you know, where you can actually play, you know, so and served your own role within that esports area. Like, I would love to see you design again, though. That would be awesome.
Yeah, I think I have matured a lot. But, you know, every game designer goes through so much. It's like we're artists, right? Just like musicians, just like writers, just like painters and whatnot. Game designing is an art, and your life evolves and your reflection evolves and the things you want to design evolves. It's quite often why you see people staying for 10 years at a big company like EA or Ubisoft and then usually kind of leave to create their own thing before eventually potentially coming back or not, because at some point you have matured your craft within within the corporate role and world, and you need space for creativity. And then sometimes in these big companies, you don't really have it, you know? That's how I felt when I left, you know? I felt I was there. It doesn't mean that one day I won't go back or that, you know, whatever. We'll see. But it's very interesting to see game design evolve as an art.
Yeah. Now.
Yeah.
And I think game design, like, it seems like there's so many different skills that you sort of have to have. Like, it's a lot of, it demands a lot of you, you know? Like, when you're trying to create on that high of a level, you're really utilizing quite a bit of skills. I want to see you do it. I want to see you do it.
One day. I keep bugging Max because he programs. I'm like, let's make our own games.
And he's like, that would be awesome.
He's like, I don't know.
You could make it about how you get a cat, a virtual cat.
Yeah, I would love to just even do like stupid, silly phone games. You know, it doesn't have to be SimCity.
exactly.
Like, you know, just like tiny little things.
You don't need to sell a million copies of your first game. But anyway, I know we have to wrap this up. Guys, if you're listening and you have a story that you would like to share and make an entry on the Game Diary podcast, you can send it to us. You can go to our website, thegamediaries.com, and send us your story, because we'd love to hear it and read it on the podcast and share how video games have affected your life.
Thank you so much, Michelle, for this amazing story. We come out every Tuesday. Let us know in the comments. Also, rate our episode if you can. It really does help us a lot to go at the top of these rankings. And we're doing great already. Yeah. Thank you. And we'll see you next week for another episode of The Game Diary.